1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are alone. Yesterday they told you you would not go far. That night you open and there you are. Next day on your dressing room they hung a star. Let's go. The costumes, the scenery, the makeup, the props, the audience that lifts you when you're down. The headaches, the heartaches, the backaches, the flops, the sheriff who escorts you out of town. The opening when your heart beats like a drum. The closing when the customers don't come. Word before the show has started that your favorite uncle died at dawn. On top of that, your partner has parted. You're brokenhearted, but you go on. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are low. Even with a turkey that you know will fold, you may be stranded out in the cold. Still, you wouldn't change it for a sack of gold.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hoag, your host. Glad to have you with us on this Monday here in the city as you listen to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station, right here in Kansas City. A lot can change in a week.
It sure can, Mike.
A lot has changed here at the radio station and in the world in general. We're pretty much on lockdown here. I shouldn't make fun of it. I'll get in trouble.
And that includes show business.
That's it. Well, show business goes on to a degree, but it has closed for the most part around, and we'll be talking about some of that in the course of the program today. But my previously scheduled guest, Joe Vaughn, couldn't cancel him at the last minute. He insisted. So he's here. But
just a friend here to bail you out.
That's right. But we're going to do our best to talk about some interesting things and entertain you if you're quarantining yourself. We want you to be entertained.
That's a good time to listen to radio.
It is a good time.
Radio makes a comeback.
Radio, radio has made a comeback in trying times. It really has. Joe Vaughn is an author, well, former newsman, KCMO Radio, KCMO Radio News.
Right. KCKN, AM and FM, and WDAF, Kansas City is 61 country.
So you've had a lot of experience in stuff like this.
In radio.
Over the years in radio.
But what we're going through right now is certainly a new experience.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking before we went on the air about the similarity to 9/11.
Yes.
And that there are fewer people out. There's a lot of panic. There's a lot of mistrust, fear, and angst about what happens next. And I was listening to Chris Keel. He owns Corporate Armada, which is a consultancy in Kansas City, Missouri. And he was saying that one of the awkward situations right now for both the political community and the financial world is not knowing exactly what to do next, that this situation is entirely different than 2008. Because in 2008, there were reserves. And you may recall we had the QE, quantitative easing. There was the QE1, the QE2, and the QE3. But the situation now is different than that over the decade, we have the United States has gotten into a terrific deficit of, what is it now, about $23 billion. Interest rates already artificially low for some time. After 2008 were held at zero, they'd just been reviving in the last couple of years. And last Friday, they were lowered to 0.25%. So the ability of the Treasury Department to maneuver is very, very minimal. And that's what they're trying to figure out.
Yeah. Yeah, the things get confusing. I'm glad you followed that so well. Kiel did a good job, I guess.
Yes, he did a very good job. And then I grew up in a business family in retailing, involved in a bank and a savings and loan. So this used to be the dinner table talk when I was a kid about what was going on in the business and economy and home building and loans and small loans. I actually used to go out with my father when he would go out and look at homes that were being built and why they would or would not grant a loan, because if the property was in a low area, in a valley, so to speak, he would say that he didn't want the savings and loan taking a risk because there were chances of water problems in the basement, or he'd always look for high ground and issues that many people wouldn't think about. And sometimes that is why home developments get in trouble if their loans are arranged carelessly and the subsequent homes are built and they have damage that makes them lose their value. So I got in a little early as a kid on seeing how some of these things are arranged. And although the circumstances are never the same twice in a row, there are certain rules that follow from era to era and crisis to crisis that do remain unchallengeable.
Sure.
And right now, in addition, we might consider the scare that everybody went through with the Y2K. You remember that in 1999?
Yes.
And how everyone was afraid that when we hit 2000, the computers would not react to it and we'd lose everything and there would be total chaos. Well, that turned out to be a false alarm.
Uh-huh.
But it scared the bejeebers out of everyone, particularly in the financial community.
Sure.
And then we had the 1987 Dow drop. The thing that's different now is the scale. When the market dropped 800 points in that October day in 1987, the base was much more narrow. Well, we've dropped, 6,000 or 8,000 points now in the last 10 days. And we're still at around 21 or 22,000. When I came in, the market was off 1,600 points so far today. Okay. That's horrific. That's scary. But the base is so much wider now. So as they calculate what to do, they've got to remember that they're working with a whole new scale of statistics. While it's very scary, it may not be as bad as it was then. The market in 1929, I think, was only at about 250 or 300. The scale was so much smaller 80 years ago.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And when you look at some of those figures, it gives even the average guy like you or me a little different perspective on it. And that's what folks in the public need to keep in mind is the scales in each era. They're working with different bases. So while a fall on the market is happening, the outcome can't be as easy to forecast because in different eras, the circumstances are never the same.
Yesterday, I heard one of the so-called experts. I always say so-called because
exactly.
Who knows? Said, when you know it's reached its absolute bottom, buying opportunity.
Oh, the old buy low, sell high thing, yes. And I should say that I'm not making my comments as any expert in anything, but as one who is a lifetime observer of things. And I, as you may know, vacuum up every newscast that's on radio and TV. And I also am very proud of the fact we have people that they read the New York Times. That's their Bible.
Uh-huh.
Or they listen to CNN, or they listen to Fox. I listen to all of those, including CBS, NBC, ABC, and PBS, and get a broad range of opinions. And I'm always a skeptic of what I'm hearing because I know in the end, nobody really has the answer. Nobody really knows. Maybe God knows, but he doesn't say very much directly. But it helps if you have faith. and it makes the blows a little softer. But then these so-called experts are just what you said, so-called. Chris Keel, the man I referred to here in Kansas City with Corporate Armada, is probably the most accurate forecaster or observer in the Kansas City area. He has traveled the world. I've heard several of his lectures. He talks about the lifestyle in Iceland, the lifestyle in Scandinavia, what's different about France, Britain, and Germany, and Spain and Portugal. All of these different countries, while they are Western and they're not closed societies like China, which is a closed society, North Korea and Russia, they all have differences, and some of those are have to do with their geographical location, their cultural proclivities, and it makes it very different. The United States has gone through a long period of expansion here since 2008, and what goes up must come down, and right now maybe gravity is doing its job. But we also need to look at the fact that in addition to the coronavirus coming, there's also been playing off in the background the oil issue between Saudi Arabia, Russia, and Iran. Well, the oil prices are down so low now, it's not only giving you a good price at the pump, but there's no reason for any of the oil-producing countries to produce oil because the market's dropped out of it. And part of what caused that was the United States became an oil-exporting country, and we no longer needed total dependence on the countries in the Middle East. About 60 days ago, it was announced that the state of Texas, they like to be big in everything, you know, had become the seventh largest oil-producing entity in the world. That puts them ahead of a lot of the countries in the Middle East, and that has roiled the Middle East, because we don't need the Saudi prince's oil like we used to. So there's market turmoil in the oil industry in addition to the virus, and it's a very complicated situation.
Sure. Getting back to the virus, your most recent book was about your grandfather,
yes,
a World War I doctor, and the subject came up. The last time there was something like this was the 1918 scare.
Yes,
and you said that your grandfather was involved in that somehow.
Yes, he was. He was an MD surgeon who volunteered for World War I in 1917, about a year or 18 months before it ended. And he went to France, where in addition to the war, they were also fighting the flu pandemic. And he came back after getting discharged as a colonel from Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, came back and worked here. He was involved in all of the hospitals in Kansas City, Kansas, and the KU Medical Center. And the flu pandemic of 1918 is now believed to have started in Kansas, in Fort Riley, and probably went to Europe, the European war arena, and in World War I, as soldiers carried it, much as we are now worried about carriers bringing it, human carriers, mm-hmm, bringing the disease into the United States from European countries, and that's largely why the country's basically been quarantined and shut down. But it did start in Kansas.
Do they know what caused it to start in Kansas?
I don't know that that's officially been pinned down. It was believed to have been in the Fort Riley area, which was a military base 100 years ago. That's also a heavy agricultural area, and I don't think they've ever actually been able to pin down if it may have had an agricultural element to it. They're going to be working very hard, although working with China is difficult because it's a closed society, to find out what generated this flu now. There's a much greater capability to determine things like that, but when the society who where it emanated from is a closed society, it makes it very difficult.
Yeah, and we are a much more mobile society, so restrictions on that probably would help the most. But how do you do that?
Yes.
There was a lot of people went to work this morning, because I was amongst all of that. So you know, people are still getting around. I hope they're being careful wherever they are.
Well, that's true. And wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands.
That's right.
And
anything that would cause it to spread. And washing hands is a big part of that.
Yes.
Not getting in other people's space quite so much would help. How far away should we stay?
6 feet is what I have heard repeated several times.
Well, we're six feet apart, aren't we? Let's not get any closer.
And shake hands by elbow.
That's right.
So,
or we could do the, as is going around Facebook, the universalist fox sign for greeting.
Yes.
Yeah, with the fingers and all that. If you're a Star Trek fan, you know what I'm talking about. If you're not, it's just an unusual
hand gesture. It's not four fingers. It's not that universal one finger.
And it's not one finger, no. But things like that, you know, for a while now. The thing is, we don't know how much of a while now.
It was interesting. Last night, I had to go to a CVS store, or at least I thought I had to, because I had a coupon that was going to expire at midnight. And I drove north on Metcalf toward 75th and Metcalf. And notice that there's a Quick Trip on the east side of the street. There's a McDonald's and a Burger King on the west side of the street. There were two cars in the Quick Trip lot. There was no one in McDonald's. Now, that's really, you know, it's a rough Sunday night when there's nobody at McDonald's.
Sure.
There were two cars in the drive-up window at Burger King. The Bergen Barrel behind the CVS, no cars in the lot. There was only one person in the CVS. Very few cars. It was like about 2 a.m. in the morning. And not that I hang out at 2 a.m. in the morning, but it was a deserted street, in all seriousness. And so people are taking it quite seriously. However, in a free society like the United States, it's very difficult to get a 100% compliance. They can do that in countries that are non-democratic, totally socialist, communist countries, and people can be arrested and put in jail. And, of course, the one country that's saying nothing that is the most closed society is North Korea.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they certainly do that. But it doesn't seem to help. China is still the worst place. The question I would have, how did that get to Iran? Iran and Italy also have one of the higher percentages of having the virus. Why Iran? That's a pretty closed society.
I think the general speculation I've heard from listening to all these various networks I claim to, and I really do listen to, is before it was actually announced in Korea or China being a closed society, kept it secret for a long time, but there is a lot of travel and interaction between Italy and China and Iran and China, if no other reason but their geographical locations. Uh-huh. And if the information was being withheld, that may, caution the word, could be why those countries got infected so quickly. And also, they don't have as sophisticated medical systems as the United States does. Now, we're hearing a lot of people criticize the fact that there are not more tests available. But when something hits this suddenly and with the ferocity this has hit, it would be incredibly difficult to expect a country of 320 million people. I think Italy's about 68 million. 320 million people to have tests for all of those people just standing by at the health department, because as we all know, any of these things that are prepared have a short life to them, and they would quickly be no longer effective, and there'd be a lot of waste in preparing these kinds of tests and then trying to store them. The counterbalance to that is we have the most awesome medical system in the world. I don't doubt that one iota, and I think they're working very, very hard. I think they will come up with something very soon. We hope it's very soon, but I'd a lot rather weigh the odds of it coming to reality here than in other places in the world. We have some just fantastic scientific people right down here at the KU Medical Center in the Kansas City area, the Mayo Clinic, many, many other fine facilities around the United States, and I'm sure they're working very hard.
Oh, I know that they are. I hear the talk, and they are working very hard. They also point out that, you know, we're behind on our DNA testing. They yes. are way behind, and in some cases, years behind, on their DNA testing. So you see various criminals only after a few years does their DNA come out.
Well, that's, yes, that discussion you hear a lot in law enforcement because sometimes the lab testing gets 10 or 12 years behind. That the volume of crime is up over years ago. The number of people waiting to be tested, there are just a lot of issues. Getting trained personnel who can administer those tests, getting labs to then read the tests. In the more rural counties in the United States, just since we're here in Missouri and Kansas, focus a little more there, some of those counties are losing their hospitals, and they have to come to Topeka or metropolitan Kansas City or Wichita or St. Louis or Springfield because the high costs of running small community hospitals have caused a lot of them to close.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a crunch in that respect.
Yes, but yeah. As far as my grandfather was concerned, excuse me.
Yeah, 6 feet now.
6 feet, yeah, 6 feet from the microphone. And there simply were no, none of these modern testing facilities available then. And he didn't live long enough for me to ever know him, but I would like to have known or heard how in 1918 they dealt with this issue when they had, there was also a typhoid pandemic too. That hasn't been brought up much in the news, but in my researching what he did in his career and his work as an MD physician and surgeon, there was a typhoid outbreak 100 years ago, and that's almost as mean a disease and as much of a killer disease as the flu pandemic was of 1918.
Yeah. Well, these things just seem to pop up, and sometimes they are able to determine. Other times it's a mystery and remains a mystery for many, many years.
Yes. Some people who want to theorize, and I don't want to get too far off into the weeds on this, that it's a natural part of Mother Nature's way of thinning the herd. That's a horrible thing to,
yes, it must be.
To say, but I think it's also a reality to point out in a situation like this. It hits primarily the elderly and most vulnerable people, the sick and the people who are the most infirm. The younger you are, the more healthy you are, and the more you wash your hands, the more likely you are to either have a very light case of it or not have a case of it at all. They're just some very grim, very cruel realities that come into play whenever a situation like this arises.
How long did the one in Joe? We're talking with Joe Vaughn, historian, author of several books,
yes.
Including the book about his grandfather, a World War I doctor who was involved in the 1918 outbreak. Boy, how did he? Did he ever? Well, you didn't know him.
No.
Did he pass on to your father or mother how long this stood around and how they treated? They didn't have the isolation facilities for the most part. How they treated that back
no.
in 1918?
No, I do know though that how different medicine was in 1918. He had a house, of course. And he had a cot in the basement that was still there when I was a youth and visited my grandmother. And in those days, you know, there weren't that was, the cars were just becoming common in the 20s, the roaring 20s. And so people would go to the doctor's house. The doctor's name was in the phone book, and he had a cot in the basement. He had a small facility there for treating people on an emergency basis. There were no EMTs and fire trucks. If there's an emergency today, a sophisticated EMT vehicle rolls up, and generally a fire truck from whatever jurisdiction it's in. often the doctor had to treat those people in his house. And if they lived or if they were taken to a hospital, the funeral homes ran the ambulances. They weren't run by the fire departments then or county EMTs like we have in Jackson, Johnson, and Wyandotte counties and the surrounding counties in Kansas City. And so it's amazing how far we've come in the last 100 years. And in writing that book, I found the stage that medicine had advanced between the Civil War in 1865 and World War One in the 19-teens was very little compared to the way it advanced in the next 20 years to World War II, when you began to have medevac helicopters and ambulances that were much more sophisticated in just that 20 or 25-year period. So the abilities of the times dictated the outcomes a lot, too. We have a wonderful, I think, one of the things that folks should feel more comfortable about is we have the most awesome, qualified, and wonderful medical people in the history's ever known right now.
We do, fortunately.
Yes.
We do. We'll have a few minutes remaining. See, time goes so fast.
Oh, it does.
Tell us about
when you're not necessarily having fun talking about very serious subjects.
It's very serious, and it's not a lot of fun. Tell about your books, the names of them, where they can be gotten. You're an expert on Wyandotte County.
Well, I'm expert on Wyandotte County and all of Kansas City, too. It's a vast, wonderful area in terms of a vast amount of history. A lot of history here. Your hometown, Independence, always surprises me. The Queen City of the Trails, where the California, Oregon, and Santa Fe wagon trains all left. And how I talk to people from Independence, and they don't know that.
No, because they don't teach it in the grades, at least the grade school I went to. It was not a big subject. I think it was mentioned. But then we moved on to other subjects.
Yes.
Cholera was a problem, I know, back in the 1840s during the trail. Not so much in Independence as in other places because of the underground water supply.
Right. And I always, when I talk about, one of my books was about Thomas Johnson. Johnson County is named after him in the Shawnee Indian Mission. And one of the things that really catches people's attention is when I tell them that when they left the Shawnee Indian Mission in those wagon trains 180 years ago, it was 1,700 miles to Sacramento, and there were no Quick Trips.
No.
And there were no Motel 6s. It was just road with rocks and dry and creeks. And one of my books was about an historic radio station, KCKN AM and FM. Call letters come out of the Kansas City, Kansan newspaper. And then I did a book on Kansas City, Kansas for the Arcadia Publishing Company. Arcadia publishes the books on cities. There's one on Kansas City, Missouri. I think there's one on the Hyde Park subdivision. And very interesting books. They're very well produced. I'm honored that they asked me to do their book. And they feature pictures. Everybody wants to see where their father or their grandfather worked, like the packing houses, things that are gone now. The original streetcars that were real streetcars, old movie theaters.
There was lots of really good movie theaters and live entertainment venues.
Yes.
There was just as many, if not more, than there are now.
Vaudeville. This was a big vaudeville area, since we're talking about Arts Magazine here.
Sure.
There were, I've told several people of when I was a kid going to a place called the Tower Theater. Have you ever heard of the Tower Theater?
This is just the name.
It was on 12th Street, and it sat about 1,500 people, had three balconies. And it was called the Tower Theater because out front it had a very elegant tower that was 180 feet tall. And it was built in the 1920s. And in Kansas City, Kansas, there was the Electric Theater. It sat over 1,000. It had a vaudeville stage and an orchestra pit.
Wow.
And it was built in 1906. So as long as we're on Arts and Magazine, probably got a little touch on a little of the great theaters that were once
true.
A part of this metropolis, and most of them have now been bulldozed.
We'll need to have you back and talk about these subjects further. But quickly, your books, the names of them, and where they can be gotten.
KCKN, Thomas Johnson and the History of Fairway, Colonel Wilkinson's Diary, and Kansas City, Kansas, all available on Amazon, Rainy Day Books, or Varsity Sporting Goods at 77th and Parallel in Kansas City, Kansas.
Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Made the arrangements too late to change anything. I'm glad you could still make it.
Well, thank you, sir. I'd be glad to help you out anytime.
We don't know when you'll be on again.
No,
We'll see. We'll see how things shake out.
I'm just a radio interloper now.
That's right. Joe Vaughn, book author, historian, former radio newsman, here with us in the first half hour of the Arts Magazine. Thank you for dropping by.
Thank you, Mike.
Be careful going home. Sometimes it's a little strange out there, but we all understand why. People react differently in these situations. So thanks for coming by. We're going to take a brief break. When we return, we're going to talk about, well, a lot of entertainment venues are canceling things. One of those being our friends at the Barn Players in Northeast Kansas City, northeast of downtown anyway. And the president of the board is here, and she's going to talk about that, and the artistic director of the Barn is here. And we're going to talk about how people cope in a situation like that when we return. You're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI. 90.1 FM.
Freeze Frame!
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons with Freeze Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare to local theaters. The Hunt is an ultra-violent, pitch-black satire that's trying to tap into the zeitgeist. A group of wealthy liberal elites entrap citizens with hard-right political beliefs and then hunt them down like game. Betty Gilpin from GLOW leads the cast as an Afghan war vet who gives her captors more than they bargained for. The Hunt is a decadent and utterly shameless movie, but it's skillfully made and it's a well-paced thriller that many will consider a guilty pleasure. Wendy is an art house reworking the Peter Pan story. Writer-director Ben Zeitlin's arty style will be immediately recognizable to anyone who saw his first feature, Beasts of the Southern Wild. Unfortunately, the tone of Wendy is so dour that it overwhelms and suffocates its occasionally magical moments. The tragic true story of Christian music star Jeremy Camp's first marriage provides the basis for the romantic drama I Still Believe. K.J. Apa and Britt Robertson star in this sweet-natured tearjerker that goes through very familiar paces, but manages to push viewers' emotional buttons. And Then We Danced is a film from Georgia about the sexual awakening of a young dancer in Tbilisi. He struggles with poverty as well as his society's repressive traditional mores as he tries to make it in the masculine arena of the National Georgian Ensemble. It's a realistic and well-made glimpse into stereotyping and self-expression. Also opening this week, Bloodshot is a Vin Diesel action thriller based on the best-selling comic book. Swallow is a drama about a woman who compulsively swallows foreign objects. Big Time is a comic drama starring Saturday Night Live's Pete Davidson. Miss Fisher and the Crypt of Tears is a period mystery derived from the Australian TV series. And Ride Like a Girl is a horse racing drama that's also from Down Under. Well, that's it for this edition of Freeze Frame. Until next time, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI FM.
What's your point of view? If you've got something important to say, let us know. KKFI recently launched a new community podcast page on our website at kkfi.org. It already hosts an amazing selection of KKFI's on-air programming as podcasts. And we're not done. We want to give you a platform. Do you have a podcast? Or have you always wanted to try, but don't know how? Go to kkfi.org, select Community Podcasts, and click Apply to share your ideas and sign up for classes to learn how. That's kkfi.org/community-podcasts. And we hope to hear your ideas soon.
A lot of fine podcasts on the KKFI website, a lot of information, things you might want to hear again. Most of the shows can be heard again on podcasts. So your favorite program never has to end. It can go on and on and on. Well, welcome back to the Arts Magazine show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hoag, your host. Yes, it's been a week. A lot of discussions, cancellations of things, postponements of things, hoping to come back at some point in the future. But no one really knows. at this point. And it's a difficult decision to make, I'm sure. We have our friends here from the Barn Players are with us. Vita Vicalis is the president of the board of the Barn Players, and that puts her right in striking position. Glad to have you here.
When you sit at the head of the table.
That's right. And Eric Mangus, the artistic director of the Barn, is here as well. Last week, they had to cancel the show that was very promising from all the publicity about it. I was looking forward to doing the interview this morning, but the show was canceled, and perhaps rightly so, with everything that's going
Absolutely.
On.
Absolutely. We had our board meeting on Saturday, and there had been discussion all week about comfort zone of the actors and their staff and the patrons. So it was a sad, ugly decision, but a necessary one. We really had to go that route.
Sure. And there's a lot of expense goes together with putting on a show. Tech things, the rights for the show, I guess, would
Absolutely.
Come first.
People think that, okay, well, we'll just not open the show. But as you said, the rights have been paid probably for 6 months or a year in advance. The sets have been built. The props have been purchased. And even something as simple as the company that does our printing of our programs or the baker that bakes our cookies for concessions. I mean, it just really trickles down.
Yeah.
And we really want to acknowledge all of the arts organizations, equity, non-equity, community theaters, as well as the Arts Asylum. It's affecting all of us, and we know how difficult a decision it is to cancel a show and how it affects the actors and musicians and production team members. And so it's a tough time for everyone, and the best we can do is keep our social distance and pull together.
And as Eric said, it really affects the actors and the musicians differently than, you know, people who are getting paid to do a service. Many times the actors will develop relationships with their cast members. These are families. This is community theater. And to then isolate them and keep them away from their families that they develop, it's a very sad time for everybody involved.
I've been reading online. It's a dangerous thing to do these days, talking about the group in Lee Summit. I had to cancel their show, and some of the performers posted how depressed they were about that. They were so anxious to do. I guess they had done some shows. They had more to go. But one of the actresses talked about how depressed she was about it. I'm in a depression.
Yeah. Well, hopefully yesterday, I don't know if you saw it, but I posted a thing on the Barn Facebook page about artists sharing their favorite songs that they sang at the Barn. And there were 10 or 12. It was great fun. So if anybody's listening and wants to participate in that, we'd love to see what your favorite songs were that you've heard at the Barn.
What I truly admire about our cast of If Then was that they went through the same sort of grieving process of losing the show. But eventually someone posted from the production team and the cast that they were grateful they got to run through the entire show at least once before we had to cancel it. And they were talking positively about how great that was and how much they were going to miss each other. But they got a chance to do it once and listen to each other and watch each other perform. And so they were celebrating what could have been, but they also celebrated what they were able to do, even though the show isn't going to happen.
Sure. Yeah, it's a sad thing, of course. It's an expensive thing. People are thinking it, so I might as well ask, is there any chance this show could be done at some point in the future?
Well, of course, we've talked about trying to reschedule or reimagine it or do a different version of it. But there are so many other things involved, especially because we don't own the space. It's a shared space. So it's not only our schedule that we're dealing with, and you know how we schedule show after show for our season, but we're also dealing with a shared space. So it's what other rental people are doing in that space as well. So it's a domino effect. Eric and I were talking about it a few minutes ago. It's amazing one, you do one thing and you realize, oh, I need to notify them. Oh, I need to do this. Oh, I need to pay this. It's a huge endeavor. It's almost more difficult to not put on a show than to put on a show.
And truly, if we were able to reschedule it, we would also have to check in with a publishing company who has the rights, because we have rights for certain dates. Mm-hmm. We'd have to check in with them as well, make sure our cast could get back together. We would love to do it. We just, at this point, there are so many unknowns that we have no plans at this point to reschedule it.
Sure. There are a lot of unknowns. And you probably do. Do you have a schedule for 2021?
Eric would probably be the best one to talk about that.
Well, you know, it seems early, but we've actually started that process. In fact, we had a show selection committee meeting yesterday, and we talked through some shows.
There were less than 50 in the room.
That's right. we talked about the process, and then we talked about shows, and we came up with a short list that I'm not at liberty to share yet. But we are actively planning to move forward, not only with whatever we can of the 2020 season, but our 2021 season.
You seem to have been very successful with your musical. So I would say what goes into the selection, probably so many, a fixed number of musicals. And you've been heavy on musicals because you've been very successful with your musicals.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think makes us unique is our mix of shows that we do. And the fact that we're always trying to look for a balance in a season, you know, shows that directors want to direct, along with shows that actors really want to do or patrons really want to see, and trying to mix that in with the old and the new as much as possible, getting a community theater premiere in there if we can. And certainly the bottom line is doing shows that we want to do as an organization. So I think we have kind of an eclectic mix of musicals, but it's been successful for us.
Yeah, it has been very successful for you.
Don't minimize the amount of work that goes into choosing that season. Eric and his committee do a remarkable job in taking everything into consideration. I mean, you can't have three shows that are female heavy. You can't have five shows that, you know, are gay themed. I mean, it's really a selective, thoughtful balance of shows to take into consideration.
Three, and well, you have a season. Your season is usually
five shows, five, and 6x10 original
and 6x10, six altogether. 6x10, of course, would be the hardest one, probably. But
why do you say that?
Because so many different. You'd have to pick six.
That's true.
And they have to meet certain requirements of being shorter and what length.
It certainly does depend on the number of scripts we have submitted. Like some years, if the number is lower, it becomes easier to read through them and select the best. This last year was particularly difficult. We had nearly 50 scripts, and we had to narrow it down to six. But I want to give credit where credit is due. Our assistant artistic director, Lynn Reddick, heads that process, and he has his reading committee, and he chooses the directors from their applications and their interests, and he basically produces the entire show. It's kind of his baby.
Yeah, and has been for a while now.
He's
come several years now talking about that.
And our friend Michael Ruth, who lives in Philadelphia now, actually it was his idea. This is our 13th,
up. 13th.
So it would have been about 2007, 2008. Michael Ruth came up with this idea. He's a playwright in his own right, but he's in Philadelphia now. But he came up with the idea, and we've just forged forward with it. And it's been great. It's given some new playwrights great starts to create, to have the freedom to create, and to take some of those short 10-minute plays and expand them to longer pieces that have gotten them some local, regional, and national attention.
Now, do you have certain dates? I know you do, but I don't know what they are. So I'm going to ask when you want, and what do you want at first? Do you just want a letter at first, and I am submitting, and then they submit online later on?
We have a submission process. I think our deadline is usually by the end of August.
Oh, okay.
We take submissions, and as long as they're within a 250-mile radius, I believe it is.
300 now.
Is it 300? Mm-hmm. Okay. See, I told you it's Lynn's baby. And they can submit a script, and they don't have to to that is their application. The submission of the script is their application. We have a blind submission process, so we have an outside person who gathers all the scripts, takes the names off of them, and then gives them to the reading committee so they don't know who wrote what script.
So if they're a friend of yours, there can be no favoritism shown.
Yeah, and I think it's a great process because it doesn't color your vision of, you know, who wrote this.
And you, of course, want it to be one that has not been done before at another locale.
Yeah, they have to be original pieces that have not been produced before.
Okay, those are the guidelines, people, if you're working on something. That's something to think about. We're speaking with Vita Baikalis, the president of the board, and Eric Mangus, the artistic director of the Barn Players, talking about what going forward and all goes into all that. The show, If Then, of course, a wonderful musical from everything I read about it, has been canceled. They don't know if they'll be able to do it in the future, but I don't know. Do you have any hopes to start soon? I mean, it's a very hard question.
Well, one thing we do know is that we will be sticking to our planning schedule.
Okay.
As Eric said, they're in the process of putting together the short list of shows for 2021. That will be brought to our May board meeting, and we have less than 50, so we'll probably still have that, at least online, maybe. Then in June, there's a call for directors. Well, we announce the shows. Then there's the call for director applicants. We usually have about 15 who are vying for four shows because Eric usually directs one if he chooses to. And then we set up those interviews. Then we call for 6x10 playwrights. Then those are decided. I mean, it's a constant motion machine.
The nice thing about the interview process with the directors is we get a lot of new people in that we've never seen before as directors, and particularly if they're trying to get their foot in the door, but they're not quite ready for a main stage show, we always keep them on the list for the 6x10 because then they can get a barn experience as well as something else for their resume. And we've had several directors that have taken on that challenge, and that's why we're so proud of that process, but also the 6x10 festival.
And you get a chance to look at their work, how they've handled this, even if in a short basis, it gives you an idea.
Absolutely.
And it's a lovely experience for the actors in 6x10 as well. This is the one time we don't really concentrate on auditions. If a player, if the director of one of the shows needs to hold auditions, we have like one cattle call audition process. But for actors who are busy with work or they really don't have the time to invest in a 5 to 6 week rehearsal schedule, but they just want to dabble in it, it's a wonderful opportunity. It's like two or three rehearsals and then one weekend of performances, and that's it. That's the only commitment they need to make.
And you bring up a good point. Oh, this has been several years ago, if not more. A woman inquired as to how this would work. She wanted to be in a show. It was hard for me to believe they wouldn't know how this works. I says, well, you go to auditions, get cast. Hopefully you would be cast. And then if it's a musical, maybe an 8 week rehearsal schedule. Maybe if it's less than that, maybe only six. But she goes, that long? I says, yes, that has been pretty standard for a long time. That's how long the process takes. Then the show will run for 2 or 3 weeks, and then you get to have your big cast party.
Right.
But yeah, it's an arduous process. Some people don't know that that's what it takes.
Well, and also, once again, in community theater, you have to remember that most of our actors, directors, musicians have day jobs. So the process might be a little faster in an equity house, but for the community,
it's a lot faster.
Yeah. For the community theaters, you have to work with their schedules.
So. What is it in the equity house? Is it 10 rehearsals? 10 full day rehearsals? And that's 8 hours a day.
They probably come off script to rehearsal.
Equity house.
They're supposed to have lines down.
2.5 weeks.
Yeah. They're supposed to have their lines down when they arrive.
So it was 12 rehearsals, yeah.
Even that presents a problem sometimes. I know stories I can't talk about.
Yeah.
But they're supposed to come with the lines learned. So you get right into the meat of the acting. And they're professionals, yes, but that's the only way they could really get ready.
Well, and as Vita noted, you know, our folks have day jobs, and so we rehearse 3 hours a night, five nights a week. Equity houses, you know, that's their job. And so they'll rehearse 8 hours a day, 6 days a week for a couple of weeks, and then they'll go into tech, you know. It varies by equity house, but that's probably pretty common, I would think.
And you have people with all kinds of work schedules.
Oh, we have everything from, you know, bar servers, people who work out of their homes. We have ad people. We've got teachers, doctors, lawyers, you name it. Every facet of employment. The other thing about the rehearsal process, that's when our people really develop that sense of family and community, and they get to know each other. And I think that's one of the things that feeds into that sense of community in the community theater.
And you see some that will go on for many years doing various parts. For some, it's only a very short time and then mm-hmm. backing out. Some, after they've got their family raised, they come back. I've heard that stories a lot.
Some will go from the community theater into the equity theaters.
Sometimes
that
they do.
Happen a lot. Mm-hmm. And I want to acknowledge the professionalism that our directors, our production team members, our designers, musicians, our actors have. Having worked with them on stage and off and watched them in rehearsal, not only do they create a sense of family atmosphere and they truly love being around each other, but they still come at the show with a very professional attitude, and they want it to be as good as any equity house in Kansas City. And quite often it is, and that makes me more proud than anything about the Barn Players.
A lot of the directors I've noticed come from the academic community. They teach school, or sometimes they teach drama in school. Sometimes they teach other subjects. Mm-hmm. But they seem to be able to handle the people better. Mm-hmm. There's an experience with directing. You have to be a little mm-hmm. higher up on the ladder than that.
Like coaching or... Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know,
handling the people is probably the most difficult thing.
It's interesting how many of our actors, their day jobs are so completely divorced from any type of creative mm-hmm. outlet. And this is their creative outlet. This is the other side of you know, their life, of their being human. And so we are part of their creative outlet. And that's something that's great that we can provide.
One thing that made me particularly sad to have to cancel shows was the fact that with our move from Johnson County to KCMO, with every show, we have a whole handful of new talent that shows up. And in this particular show, if then, half of the cast had never done a barn show before. So that's lovely to see this new influx of energy and talent and still maintain our stable of regulars over
sure.
the years. So that's really exciting.
The fact that you do a lot of musicals, I think, helps you a lot.
Interestingly enough, Michael, and Eric can attest to this, we are amazed every year when we do the director interviews that more times than not, the more people will want to direct the play.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But as far as audition numbers...
Yeah, our actors, we're seeing a huge influx of new faces that we've not seen... We had not seen when we were over on in the Martway Theater, and it's just been kind of a joy to meet so many new people. I've also noticed over the last couple of years that I think, based on, I hope, our reputation for doing good work, that we've had so many actors that have auditioned that will say to me, "Oh, we just moved to town and this is my first show." So they're looking for, you know, on social media, they're looking for the theaters that are doing good work or doing the shows they want to be a part of. And we seem to fortunately be attracting actors who have just moved to Kansas City. Or I've even gotten emails from actors who are planning to move and mm-hmm. want to introduce themselves to our theater. And I'm so grateful for that.
Yeah. Well, new faces are really the blood of it. Because we love the old favorites. There are certain actors, even community theater actors, people love to see. Mm-hmm. And when they hear they're in the show, they'll make special plans.
Absolutely.
Well, and sometimes a certain director will attract a certain crowd of actors because they've worked together before, they know the work, they like working for that director, and then you bring in this whole onslaught of new talent, and it's something else for that director to weigh out. You know, do you go with a sure bet, or do you infuse your cast with something new?
I suppose you have to infuse a little.
And they have been.
There are favorites, but you have to work in the new ones, too, because the new ones will become the favorites.
That has been the case. This last couple years, we've had a couple people move to town, and they've been in almost every show. They've truly developed a family at the barn.
Yeah. So. Well, that's good that you can do that, especially having moved about the community the way you have. You went from the west side in Kansas to the east side, the Arts Asylum is just a little bit east of downtown Kansas City. With the construction wrapping up, it's very easy to get from downtown over to the barn. 9th Street goes right across now. Mm-hmm. So that's been easy for you. Have you noticed a pickup since those streets got completed?
It's so much easier, and the bridges look great, and most of our season ticket holders, we call them flex passes, stayed with us during the move. We lost a few who are, you know, just nervous about the area, but honestly, the area is probably safer than many areas because the police station is right on the other side of the bridge.
Sure.
So, you know, we have security people helping with the parking, and it's easy access from both the east and from every direction in town now. So that's even easier than our previous location.
Yeah. Well, this gives you an idea, I hope, of the kinds of problems that the various organizations have had to deal with here amongst this crisis going on. Mm-hmm. And planning for the future. No one really has an idea when things will let up. You know, it's still kind of a mystery at this point.
I think, though, that people will be starved enough for live theater that they are going to be so grateful when we finally open up.
I think so. And we really can't give you a calendar on that. But they're going to resume their season, I guess, calendar-wise, from where you would have been at the time when that happens. If it's in the summer, you'll get the summer show. I assume that if it's in the fall, you'll get whatever fall shows you have planned. And you're going to plan for, and you're planning that for next season, even now.
Currently, the Laramie Project is scheduled to open May 14th. We're just on a wait-and-see attitude. We've kind of pushed the pause button on that one. At this point, but it is still on the schedule. We have Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which is a Kansas City premiere, coming up in August, and then The Secret Garden returning. I think it's our third time doing the show. Mm-hmm. We love that musical. It's coming in November, and then the 6x10 at the end of the year.
Sure. So you can go to their website. And I know we're not giving you much information on where, when, and how, but you can always go to their website, which is thebarnplayers.org, and they will keep you updated, as well as the other theaters in the area, when they'll be back, what their plans are. There's a lot of unknowns at this point, but things will improve. We just don't know when yet. But in the case of the Barn Players, it's the, and you have to work the in there. Mm-hmm. TheBarnPlayers.org, and they do shows, just for your future note, at the Arts Asylum, 1000 East 9th Street. It's just on the east side of downtown, in the downtown Kansas City area. Thanks so much for coming over.
Thank you, Michael.
And talking about this, it's not an easy discussion, I know, but people were curious. And they can always find out. And if you're more interested in another theater group, check out their website as well. I'm sure by now everyone has some idea of their plans on their website, if only to say nothing is going to happen for a little while. But still, you'll know by going to your local theater's website.
We certainly want to wish all of the other theater performing arts companies our best, because we all are in this together. We all know what they're going through, and hang in there.
Sure. Vita Vicalis, the president of the board of Art Flares, until death, probably.
Which may be around the corner.
Oh, don't say that. And Eric Mangus, the artistic director of the Barn Flares, just checking in with us to see how things are going. I don't know when we'll have another live show. They're discouraging live guests for a little while, but we'll find out. And we'll keep you apprised on what's going on in the theater community. That's why we're here, as you listen to us here on 90.1 FM KKFI. One thing that will be a constant is Sam Wiseman. He is the Jazz Insider, and we'll have jazz from 1 to 3. We'll have the blues from 3 to 6. That won't change right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that